This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Let's set your Business Week agenda on this Thursday afternoon. We've got Michael McKee, International Economics and Policy Correspondent at Bloomberg News, here in our Interactive Broker studio. So too is Kriti Gupta, Anchor and Markets Correspondent at Bloomberg. Got to start with the trade here because I agree, you know, like we just haven't seen a rally like this in a long time.
We absolutely haven't. And, you know, this is going to be a fun combination of or confluence of a bunch of different factors. Now, the immediate one, the biggest one, I would argue, is that CPI report we saw this morning, 8:30 a.m., futures shot up like a hockey stick, I say. Yeah, absolutely. So to see this is pretty interesting. I want to put some context, though, because Dan Curtis, our markets producer du jour, did actually crunch the numbers a little bit. And he said, if you invested in the S&P 500 year to date, you lost about 21% on your portfolio. If you invested only on the days that you had a CPI report, so basically the 10 days or the 10 reports you've had, you've only lost 7%. Huh. So basically a third of the market's losses this year so far have been a direct relationship to those CPI numbers, which speaks to just how sensitive the market is. Also keep in mind that a lot of the shorts that were kind of positioned in the market in the last couple of weeks, a lot of them were kind of liquidated before the election, the midterm election. The right. idea here being that gridlock was going to be a good thing for the markets. A Republican red wave would then once again be a positive. So a lot of the shorts were taken out of the market. So the confluence of that, the CPI report, and then of course the idea, I would say a little bit of a sigh of relief.
So this isn't short covering because they were already taken out.
It's not a short covering.
Okay.
From what I hear just from my sources. But then also keep in mind a little bit of a sigh of relief of what's going on in the crypto sphere, because yesterday there was the big question of, is there a contagion? Today, perhaps not so much.
Right, right. Exactly. All right. So let's come in with Mike. I was listening to him this morning break it on Bloomberg Surveillance. That CPI print, it's down.
It's something.
We still have a ways to go, but it's a trend line that continues to go down,
well,
right?
Well, if you look at the reaction in the equity market, certainly, you're welcome.
Exactly.
I mean, the rooster gets credit for the sunrise. I get credit for breaking the story. It's down, and it was down more than anybody could have anticipated. Now, that's a relative judgment, because 7.7% on a headline and 6.3% on the core is still quite a bit. But it suggests that we're going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. We don't know because it's only 1 month, but the overall number, especially in the core, there were a lot of things that went down in price, which we had not seen. For the most part, what you're looking for is the rate of inflation slows. But in this case, there were actual declines. Milk went down. Orange juice went down. Bacon went down, which is always
important.
The most important item out
there. I'm with you on that.
Used cars went down. So, yeah, basically you're looking at what could be a turning point. And I think that's what the markets were reacting to, is because it was more than expected, more than anybody had thought possible, it's okay, this is a change. This is the turning point. It will lead the Fed to put some sort of stopping point in place soon enough, and maybe we get that soft landing.
But is the headline number coming down? Like, I thought I had seen something on the TV side that they were talking about this was like the fourth month in a row. Is there a trend line yet or no?
No, not really. There's not a trend line yet. The problem being with the headline is that food and gasoline are still going up. Food increased less than it did the month before. Gasoline was down 5% in September and up 4% in September. So in October, rather. So, you know, the headline is subject to the vagaries of things that the Fed has nothing to do with.
So safe to say, Creedy, when you look at the markets and certainly what happened on the fixed income side of things, I mean, investors are expecting that the Fed is kind of done with not that they're done raising rates, but done with those big rate hikes.
Well, I'm not going to use the word pivot, as I was told not to by someone in this room. But what I will say is that there is. I mean, look, the commentary has already changed in literally the last 6 hours or so since we've gotten this data. The idea that the conversation of a soft landing is back into the narrative, the idea of that perhaps another 75 basis point hike is thrown out the window so far,
right.
That the quote unquote pivot that everyone was expecting going into, I want to say even last month, is actually coming, the slowdown of rate hikes, and that is actually a good sign. There's also this commentary on the jobs market specifically, because look at the layoff numbers that you are starting to see in corporate America. People all of a sudden are saying, and I want to say on Wall Street and off Wall Street, because that matters. The
right.
Markets are always going to talk about sentiment off Wall Street. They're going to not necessarily have that same timeline. They're talking about the fact that the economy is actually turning.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Mike, 20 seconds I saved for you in terms of Fed talk, because we are Fed speakers. Anything that's of note for you?
No, they basically followed a script. We've had a lot of Fed speakers today, and almost all of them said the same thing, that it is time to consider slowing down the pace of rate increases, but we've got a long way to go. And the inflation battle is not won. Inflation's still way too high. So it feeds the narrative that not going to be 75, but probably going to be 50, but there'll be another one after that.
All right. Michael McKee and Creedy Gupta, thank you so much for our market setup here on this Thursday.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Paul and I were just talking. He got his COVID vaccine, the number 5 COVID vaccine. Me too. This morning, it's the one against the Omicron variants. This as we see COVID-19 hospitalizations rising among babies under 6 months old, and the U.S. CDC is urging mothers to get vaccinated to reduce the risk of infection in those not yet eligible for shots. That was coming from the CDC Director Rochelle Walensky. Well, back with us is Dr. Ian Lusbader, Clinical Professor of Medicine at NYU Langone. He is once again on the phone in New York City. Hey, Ian, Dr. Lusbader, good to have you here with Paul and myself. So I got my COVID shot. I'm feeling kind of good. I'm running out of space on my card. Tell us about the what's going on. First of all, how are you?
Everything is great. Nice to be with you, Carol and Paul. And COVID is still with us. We've talked about this for several years and not going away yet. And some of the data, which we can talk about this time or next time in Nature Journal, the prestigious journal, we're seeing more variants out there. Dr. Walensky raises a point about seeing more COVID in really the very young and the very old. They're the most susceptible, and the CDC does not recommend vaccines for babies under 6 months, so that group is somewhat more susceptible. According to my sources, they're seeing a number of infections: RSV, parainfluenza, adeno, rhinoviruses, or this sort of virus soup that kids are coming in with. So I don't think we can say kids are getting sicker from or dying from, but they're certainly being hospitalized with COVID. And so the thought is, since antibodies cross the placenta, that mothers or pregnant women probably would benefit from getting vaccines and being boosted, because that should give passive immunity for the first few months after delivery to the babies. Complicating that, and certainly that's true for older people too, definitely be up to date. We've talked for a long time, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, those people are much more at risk. So we're not seeing a big increase in COVID deaths. The opposite, we're seeing fewer cases nationally, and the death rate is dropping as well. But for vulnerable populations, they need to be aware of this.
Dr. Lusbader, is it fair for folks to characterize where we are in this process as COVID is endemic, not pandemic?
Yes, I think that's a very good term, and I think, you know, that's what we will see. In other words, endemic, we're going to be living with it for a long time. We're seeing more and more variants. This Nature Journal talked about variant soup, XBB. Different countries are having different offshoots of Omicron. You know, which is why, in part, we need to find out the origin of the virus, you know, because this is new. We are not really living with viruses in the past that have had the ability to mutate this much and really be in every area, and vaccines are not able to keep up with the mutations. We're seeing more mutations in what's called the receptor binding domain, right? So that's where the virus attaches, and when you have more RBD changes, and we're seeing really an exponential increase in those mutations and variants, you can have as many vaccines as you want. The virus outruns you. So there's a lot more work to do. The good news is, over time, whether it's vaccines or just getting COVID a few times, people seem to be more resistant. But how this will end, we don't really know yet.
Yeah,
certainly we're going to live with it for a while, but how it will end, we don't know.
So are you anticipating, I'm curious, you know, you guys at NYU Langone, or what's the talk in the medical community, are we anticipating some other kind of spike among the general population come the fall and winter months? Or is it just like we'd see a spike in flu cases, which we know can also be deadly?
Right. Unfortunately, vaccines are not perfect, right? The flu vaccine is about 50% effective. You know, we have to take it. Certainly, you don't want the flu. It's
yeah.
not fun, and it does kill certainly people. So I think vaccines are helping, but all of these viruses are piercing a lot of those vaccines. I do think we are going to see a bit of a rise, and I'm concerned about other countries where these other variants are going on that are resistant to our bivalent vaccine. So we don't really know. Will that be another wave? It doesn't look that way at this point. The number of cases are dropping. Hospitalizations from COVID are dropping. What will happen in the winter? Hopefully it will stay in those other countries and not come to the U.S., but we're not sure.
Yeah, right. Stay tuned for all of this. Ian, thank you so much. Dr. Ian Luss-Bader, Clinical Professor of Medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it is out. It's on newsstands. It's online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And, of course, on the Bloomberg terminal. The cover story, appropriately so, is about this week's midterm elections. It's a story you'll find in the issue's remarks. It's about Republican Congressman Kevin McCarthy's dream and nightmare coming true. Here to explain, Bloomberg Business Week, national correspondent Josh Green. He is with us on the phone in Washington, D.C. Josh, good to have you here with Paul and myself. So tell us about Kevin McCarthy. His dream come true, and yet it's probably not exactly maybe like he envisioned.
Well, McCarthy is a longtime Republican House leader who has wanted to be Speaker of the House for years and years and years, was expected to be in 2015, and was sort of forced to remove himself from the race in favor of Paul Ryan before he could get in there because he just didn't have the trust of the right wing of his caucus. So over the last 7 years, he's plotted, he's raised money, he's campaigned, and it seemed like on election night he was on the cusp of taking over the speakership, maybe by a pretty wide margin. But then, of course, the red wave turned out not to be much of a wave after all. So what I write in the New Business Week is that it still looks like Republicans are going to win the House, but it's going to be a very, very narrow majority. And so it's the dream for McCarthy in the sense that he'll finally realize a speakership. But it's a nightmare because it means that the right wing of his caucus, you know, radicals like Marjorie Taylor Greene, are really going to have a lot of leverage over him. And I think that's a recipe for chaos.
There's a great quote in here from Senator Greene. She made this to the New York Times. "I think that to be the best Speaker of the House and to please the base, he's going to give me a lot of power and a lot of leeway." So that's some pressure on the next Speaker of the House, whoever that is, to really do cater to some of the right-wing elements of the Republican Party. Is McCarthy willing, able to do that?
Well, I think he's in a position where he's not going to have much of a choice. You know, he needs, in order to get elected Speaker, he needs 218 votes. And if you've got, you know, had there been a big wave and there were, you know, let's say, you know, 250, 260 Republicans, I think he might have been able to marginalize people like Representative Greene. And just to be clear for listeners, you know, this isn't somebody who wants aggressive tax cuts. She is someone who suggested a while back that forest fires in California were caused by lasers from space. She's retweeted a lot of QAnon conspiracy theories, and she was stripped in this current Congress of her committee assignments for having endorsed social media posts calling on Democratic officials to be assassinated. So we're talking way, way off the deep end, extreme right, and yet you hear from the quote you just read that she expects and is getting a lot of catering to by McCarthy simply because he needs her vote in order to assemble those 218 votes. The smaller the Republican margin is, the more leverage people like Greene and the House Freedom Caucus are going to have.
You know, Josh, it feels like the Republicans over the last few years, 5 years, 10 years, I guess, you know, have been smart when they're all kind of on a singular mission. And whether it's Supreme Court justices and, you know, different initiatives that are out there, abortion and so on and so forth. What is, though, the Republican mission at this point? What is the agenda? Because you're right that that's a problem for McCarthy because they don't really have an agenda.
Yeah, you know, it is. I mean, one of the difficulties when you have a kind of chaotic Republican Party like McCarthy does is it's hard to get people to agree. You have an establishment wing that wants you to govern responsibly. You have a radical ring that wants to impeach Joe Biden. And so Republicans this election really didn't agree on a clear set of legislative goals the way that, let's say, Newt Gingrich did in the 1994 contract with America. That was in order to focus attention on Biden and the problems with inflation and crime. And it looks like that's worked to a very narrow extent if Republicans do wind up winning the House. But the problem is it leaves a vacuum for anybody to rush in and push their issue. And so one of the things that we're going to be contending with, that Republicans are going to be contending with, is there's an element that wants to engineer another debt ceiling showdown in order to cut Medicare and Social Security. I'm sure you guys remember 11 years ago, after Republicans won the House, tried to do that same thing. We came to the brink of default, and U.S. government credit wound up being written down. So a lot of concern among both Republicans and Democrats, or at least the more responsible ones, about what exactly a McCarthy-led House would look like, what they'd be able to engineer, and what kind of problems that might cause to the global economy.
So, I mean, you point out in your piece here that, boy, it's tough to be a Republican Speaker of the House. The last two, John Boehner and Paul Ryan, they were effectively hounded out of the position and out of politics in general by the right wing of their caucus. I mean, Representative McCarthy has to be sensitive to that, cognizant of that.
You know, absolutely. I mean, the lifespan of a Republican House Speaker, it's sort of like being the drummer for Spinal Tap. Like, you're not going to be around for very long.
Nice.
And I argue in the piece, McCarthy actually has a tougher job than John Boehner or Paul Ryan, the last two Republican speakers who were both hounded out of the job by their right wings. Because the right wing is just more radical today. There's going to be a narrow majority. But the other reason is that, you know, the big influential voice on the outside who's dictating a lot of behavior, Donald Trump, wasn't on the scene for John Boehner. I mean, John Boehner couldn't hold on to his job, and it was, you know, Donald Trump wasn't even weighing in. Well, he's going to be now. You know, everybody's expecting a presidential announcement from Trump in the next couple of days or in the next weeks. You know, and he's somebody who likes to weigh in and criticize people, Kevin McCarthy in particular. And, you know, that's one more headache that McCarthy is going to have to grapple with as he tries to cobble together this narrow majority and keep his Republican caucus from revolting.
So does that mean you're expecting that he doesn't really get anything done, or maybe?
I think that's right. I think it would be considered a win for McCarthy and Democrats, you know, if we're just able to avoid a debt ceiling default. But as far as passing legislation, if McCarthy takes over and Republicans win the House, that effectively ends the period of the Biden presidency where we're getting big pieces of legislation through the House. Nothing's really going to kind of get through. The thing that I think a lot of people are worried about is, will McCarthy be able to do basic things like pass an appropriation bill, have the U.S. government pay off its debts by raising the debt limit, the basic kind of blocking and tackling that didn't used to be contentious 10 years ago, but now has become very much so, and it's really not clear, you know, is there going to be an adult in the room who can make these things happen, or is McCarthy in trouble?
Josh, really quickly, 20 seconds here, an impeachment of President Biden, is that likely to happen with him as Speaker?
It's certainly a possibility. A lot of Republicans telling Bloomberg News that that's something they want to push in the new Congress. It'll be made more difficult by the narrow majority, but I think it's something that's certain to come up.
Interesting times. They just continue. Josh Green, great cover story of Bloomberg Businessweek. It is the remarks of the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek on newsstands, on the Bloomberg Terminal, and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Josh, by the way, national correspondent at Bloomberg Businessweek, joining us on the phone in D.C., and we appreciate
that
his
sounds
thoughts.
Like a thankless job.
Be careful what you wish
exactly.
for.
Exactly.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The crypto story that was the recent cover, really entire issue of Bloomberg Business Week, was written by Bloomberg Opinion columnist Matt Levine. So I knew we wanted Matt to weigh in on this week's flurry of activity and calamity surrounding the meltdown of the crypto exchange FTX. Matt is a Bloomberg Opinion columnist covering finance, former editor of Dealbreaker, former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, so much more. He is back in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I know you're busy. You went through all the nooks and crannies of how the crypto world came to be, really taught us kind of the understanding of all of the terminology, of the significance of the development since crypto has come to be. How do you then take this week and kind of cross it with what you wrote about?
Well, I mean, one thing that I wrote towards the end of that piece was that crypto this summer had its own 2008, where it had a financial crisis caused by like over leverage and opaque interconnections between firms. And, you know, in the summer, the person bailing out the, you know, providing the bailouts to these firms that were going bust was FTX. And this week, FTX is having its 2008 crisis.
So what does that mean when the White Knight, as everybody keeps calling him, has his own crisis?
Well, it's bad.
Okay, that works.
I mean, it's bad because like the place where you thought your money was safe in crypto is not safe. It's bad also because like if you had your money somewhere else, you were like, well, if something goes wrong, FTX will bail it out, right? There was a sort of like FTX floor under the market, and now that seems to be gone as well.
All right, so there are a lot of people out there in the financial services industry, and most notably Jamie Dimon, who have not been supportive of this space, of the crypto space broadly defined. Are they right?
I mean, they certainly seem vindicated this week. Look, I mean, like you can have views about like the technology and the usefulness of tokens, but you know, when Jamie Dimon is like, this is all decentralized Ponzi schemes, like everything that comes out looking like a Ponzi scheme makes him look more right.
Right.
I don't think he's entirely right, but like he's not wrong to say this is a sector with a lot of troubles.
Right. I mean, what do you think Sam Bankman-Fried, how do you think it plays out for him? I mean, you were a lawyer.
I don't know. I mean, I still don't know what went wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that there is certainly a possibility of like something along the lines of innocent mistake crossed with like, one thing that did happen is that FTX seems to have been kind of knifed by its biggest competitor. And
yes.
So, you know, like how bad this ends up looking, I don't know, but it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Matt, I mean, you had a long conversation with SBF, right?
Yeah. I've done a few
conversations.
Interviews with
him. I mean, you know, and we've been running sot strings about kind of all the things that he has said. I mean, is it a case of, I mean, this is, I guess, what we have to get to the bottom of. What he said, was it true? back then, or is it a case of that the market got so volatile or sold off and there were so many losses that this is why we are having this discussion right now? Is it part of the market environment, or is it something specifically he did and how he ran or didn't run his businesses?
I mean, I never asked him, like, do you keep customer money safe? Because one sort of hopes that it does.
Just assume?
I think that, one thing that definitely happened here was just the failure of risk management, right? And a failure of concentrating too much money in a bet that went bad. But, like, whether that is an innocent failure or something more nefarious, is, I think it's a little too early to tell.
But there's no doubt that some very smart people made very bad decisions and lost a lot of money here. I think about the latest round of fundraising, which I think valued the company at $65 billion. I mean, there were real people in Silicon Valley like Sequoia.
Right, exactly.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
writing it down.
That.
Putting it off.
What do you think happened there? Was it just blind faith? Those guys don't invest on blind faith.
Well, I mean, so one thing is they didn't put that much money in the scheme of things, right? I mean, it was valued at $32 billion, but they're writing nine-figure checks, which is real money, but it's not like their fund.
Right.
The other thing is that, I don't know, like if you're a venture investor investing in crypto and people come to you with like some wild dream and they say in 20 years you'll pay for tweets on the blockchain, you kick in some money. But then Sam Bankman-Fried comes to you and is like, look, I make, I have real revenue. Like, we make a lot of money. Like, we're very profitable. We have lots of cash. Like, that was all true. Like, they were making money. Like one thing that is happening here is that venture capitalists are good at evaluating tech business models and maybe not so good at evaluating highly levered financial services business models.
Right.
But like, they were making money, you know?
So Matt, we take a step back. Like, one thing I feel like Bloomberg is good about is like putting things in perspective. So what is the smart perspective on this? I mean, we've got an incredible rally in the equity markets today, right? Like, they are focusing on something else. They're not focusing, at least equity investors are focusing on the inflation print today. So that the system, financial system, hasn't come down. Like, is there some smart perspective in terms of how we look at crypto at this point?
Oh, look, I mean, I think for a while now, certainly since like the bailouts this summer, it's been fairly clear that crypto could go to zero without bringing down like the financial system, right? Like, there is that crypto is still kind of isolated off on its own. It is a place where there is, hundreds of billions of dollars of notional value and where people are getting rich and where people have money, but it is not deeply tied to the real economy in a way that, like, FTX goes down, like, the people who are FTX customers will lose money, but like, the banks won't notice. It won't affect mortgages. There won't be foreclosures. There won't be like high unemployment numbers. It's just like, it is its own isolated system at this point.
Will it bring an end to crypto?
I don't think so, but it doesn't help, It doesn't help that, there's a lot of trust in crypto was undermined this summer as all these high profile firms went bust. And the person who was doing the most to restore trust was Sam Bankman-Fried, who was bailing out those firms so that their customers got made whole. And when he goes under, like, I think a lot of people are going to have real doubts about trusting anything in the crypto system.
I just want to know where he is.
Well, I think he's in the Bahamas. That's where their offices are.
Is that a good place to be?
It's a great place to
extradition-wise?
Do some snorkeling.
It's better than New York.
It is better than New York. Matt Levine, thank you so much. I know you're so busy, but I knew we wanted you to weigh in on this.
Rip out these huge columns. He's not that busy. I mean, he's just...
I think he dreams it, and then it just like comes out miraculously on paper. Matt Levine is columnist at Bloomberg Opinion, a must read here for all of us at Bloomberg and for you. Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 11 minutes left in today's trading session, and we have stocks we're seeing buying into the close, as Charlie mentioned, up more than 7% on the NASDAQ. We've got about a 5.3% gain on the S&P 500. And Paul, I mean, it is broad-based, all in.
It is. I mean, the NASDAQ is just amazing. But we've been buying them into the close here, so we've seen some strength in trading.
Yeah, pretty significant. All right, let's get to it. Let's see what Doug Sciocca has to say. He is CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners. They've got over $1 billion in assets under management based in Leawood, Kansas. That's where we find him joining us via Zoom. All right, Doug Sciocca, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Doing well.
Another with his Notre Dame shirt on today. I mean, these Notre Dame people, you can't, they're just, they wear the Notre Dame stuff everywhere.
All in, all in.
A name like Paul Sweeney, you cannot object.
You're exactly right.
You guys are cute. So, interesting day, to say the least. Yields backing off, a tremendous rally. I can't remember the last day I saw such a buy-in into the equity trade. Doug, is this it? Have we bottomed out when it comes to stocks and topped out when it comes to yields?
That's obviously a $64,000 question. It is incredible, actually, Carol, to see the Bloomberg Barclays Ag now. I think this is going to be the best day it's had a single day performance since 1982. Hmm. What's amazing is the bond rally, the stock rally, the incredible decline of the dollar, and yet the Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index in the United States is actually tightening. And I don't know if the Fed would take this as all very positive news, but could this be the peak in CPI, maybe for the core, yet to be seen yet for the headline, but yet to be seen for the core. But certainly, I think a nicely motivating factor as far as taking some of the worst case scenarios off the table.
So, I mean, I'm not sure if this is just a technical short squeeze or we've got real and long-term investors buying in here, or if this is a trade. I'm not really sure, but it's clear that to the extent anybody wasn't paying attention, this is a market that's paying close attention to the Federal Reserve, just as the Federal Reserve is paying close attention to inflation. But it's not so much earnings. It's just, what's this Fed going to do? And I guess the market's telling us today, we think we're maybe, if we're not at the peak, we're close to it.
Well, it's interesting, right? So you had kind of the Powell switcheroo last week, Paul, and you had a very dovish, or at least largely dovish statement, and then a very hawkish press conference. And then we had a couple of the Fed governors when they hit the media circuit post press conference. And they were a little bit mixed. I mean, Mary Daly seems to be reasonably dovish. And of course, Bullard and Kashkari are more hawkish. And then Loretta Mester today, who is set up to maybe throw some cold water on the rally, came out with, you know, four or five headlines around Bloomberg that probably could be interpreted as her most dovish interpretation of the new data. So if they're actually seeing, right, this long and variable lag making its way into the data, I don't know why you would need to throw fuel on the fire. And it's reflected in the reduction in the terminal rate. So the market is trying to price in what it thinks is going to be the next couple moves. And they're by no means done. And I think there's a major difference between a pivot and a pause. But when they say in the press conference, we're nowhere near considering pausing. I don't know mathematically how that is the case. If you already raised rates by 400 basis points, you're not going to raise them by 800. You certainly are past that inflection point where it at least would be something that you would have to consider in future meetings.
All right. So I'm trying to translate that. Does that mean, Doug, you think we're overdone here, certainly on the equity trade, that we're just too amped up here?
No, by no means. I certainly see that there's, whether it's short covering relief rally, I do think, like anything, there was an elevation of a liquidity concern given what's taken place in the crypto complex in the last 48 hours. I think a little reprieve if the Fed isn't going to be taking additional liquidity out of the system because of the cooling off on some of the inflation data. I think that the market is trying to find some level ground, but more than anything, you're chasing out shorts pretty quickly today. But the question always becomes, like, is this just another bear market rally? And as someone in your program a couple of weeks ago had said, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but they all look the same right at the beginning. And so the question just becomes, are we at a point where the Fed is not going to end the rally by talking down any optimism by very harsh, hawkish language. If you think what ended the bear market bump that took place in July and August, it was Powell and Jackson Hole. If you think what ended the bear market pop 2 weeks ago, it's when the Fed came out at the press conference. So if the Fed now, and the Red Emester being one of the head hawks, is talking a little less strongly, the market might take that as a higher probability that this may not be a bear market bounce, but something start of a next leg of a bull market.
Doug, if it is somewhat along that scenario that maybe, you know, the Fed is starting to taper here, it's increases, where are you suggesting folks go in this market?
Yeah, great question, Paul. I mean, I think within the equity realm, we still think defensive product sectors make sense, healthcare, staples, some industrials, but they need to sell at low multiples, right? You're not gonna get multiple expansion in a high interest rate, low growth environment. They need to have super clean balance sheets, and to the degree they can, self-sufficiency in sourcing products, okay? So we still think, right, the equity market has largely been resilient, even though the average stock is down, what, 25, 30% from its peak. There's been a lot of damage that's been done to really good companies that have been thrown at it indiscriminately and treated like very poor stocks. So there's opportunity, particularly in those three sectors. But in fixed income is likely where we're most excited, right? It's interesting when Powell talks about needing to establish positive real yields. They're there, right? 3, 5, 7, 9, 15 years out, they are positive real yields based upon the 5-year forward on the breakevens for these TIPS. So if you think about, right, everyone talks about guilt by association,
right,
collateral damage when certain classes of assets become impaired, but there's also a rising tide component. When all aspects of an asset class become more attractive due purely to their spread over the risk-free treasury, and this is fixed income. And at times like this, some of these companies actually have better balance sheets, not being cynical, than the federal government, that are offering yield premiums at 300, 400, and 500 basis points above.
How much of do you think the move today that we're seeing is because the dollar has backed off? I'm looking at the dollar index. It's down about 2.3%, and that has certainly been troubling for the profit picture. We've heard that from a lot of CEOs.
Yeah, I think it's a large part of it, Carol. There's no question. I mean, with everyone that came down to your point, the CEOs coming to the quarterly confessional and saying, we read a couple of the companies we covered this morning said the same thing, right? We have to be a little bit cautious in our revenue projections just because of the headwind of FX. Now, if that gets into the multiple and that starts to abate, then you're going to have upward surprises in the out quarters. But there's no question, Carol, you hit on one of the primary catalysts for today's move.
Hey, Doug, you're in the burbs of Kansas City there. How's the economy out there?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty strong. It's pretty resilient. One of the great things about, I mean, I'm in southern Johnson County in Kansas, but the whole sort of broad KC area, we have a very diverse revenue base, right? There are not two or three single community pillars of large public companies that employ a lot of people. So we have a very big service industry, particularly within professional services, legal, accounting, financial services. But we also have a very diverse healthcare business. There was a cast off of a company that had been kind of the kingpin of the city back in the 80s and 90s. So the economy is palpably very, very resilient.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, Doug, always fun to check in with you. Doug Scioka is CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners, as we said, over $1 billion in assets under management, based in Leawood, Kansas, and joining us via Zoom from there. Doug, take care. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.